Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Sunday, September the 10th. As we like to do on Sundays, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We're going to talk about a lot of things tonight. Hurricane Irma is obviously the big story. It's been hitting South Florida quite a lot here in the last day, and we have many friends down, including some family down in South Florida. Thankfully, everyone's okay. Some actually left the area, but nevertheless, it is amazing when you see all that water. You keep asking yourself, where did all that water come from? How can there be that much water? Well, there is, as we saw in Houston. North Korea is back in the news. I think they're threatening to shoot another missile. President Trump is now working with Democrats. Very interesting little deal that he's put together. Why he did it, I don't know. I'm anxious to hear what Bill has to say about that. Perhaps the biggest story of the week was President Trump killing the DACA program, but creating an extension to send it to Congress. So you have to wonder right now, is Congress really going to do anything about it? They should, but I don't know if they have enough time to do it in 6 months. The universities are back in session, and that just means that there are more crazy politically correct things. And I have no idea. I really don't know what is happening in our universities, but they're getting crazier by the moment, and I'm so happy that our sons have already concluded that part of their lives. But at least they went to universities where I didn't have to worry about that. But man, universities are just crazy, getting crazy and crazier all the time. Bill had a very interesting post today about people changing their habits of how they get the news, and I like to talk to him as well about that. Let's say hello. Let's put him on here. Let's say hello to our good friend Bill Katz. How are you, Bill? Are you watching the hurricane?
Just fine. Well,
the hurricane,
yes.
I mean,
well, it's been wall to wall. I mean, yeah. On the cable networks, they've been covering it. They've been covering every drop of water. And I'm just waiting for someone to get up and blame Donald Trump and say he brought the hurricane. He did this, you see. And there was actually what it was, you see, there was a plumbing leak at Mar-a-Lago. And that's what caused all this. That's what it really was.
Well, Jennifer Lawrence said that, didn't she? I don't even know
who
she
did.
Is. I just know her name. I don't even know who she is. Who is this lady? I don't even know.
She's a young and very good actress. And like many people who become famous in Hollywood, she thinks that she's a political expert now.
She is
convinced that Trump's attitude on climate change has had a lot to do with this.
I wonder, Bill, with this, as you call it, wall-to-wall, and that's what it's been, I wonder how many people after a while switch the channels. Because if you – I had to do this. I mean, I had to watch sports this afternoon, and this evening the Cowboys and the Giants are playing, so we'll be watching that. But there were times during the day where, you know, there wasn't really that much more you were learning from the coverage. I mean,
no,
how many,
you really
how
weren't.
Many more, I mean, at what point – Is it just you know, recycle and, you know, another shot of Miami and other? I mean, I wonder if a lot of people maybe were not switching channels today and saying, okay, I'll check in a half hour and see how everything is going, Bill.
Well, I think that's true. They invested a great deal. I mean, they look, bad weather makes big ratings. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they try to put the worst possible face on it. Now, I think they were not, you know, overly crazy in this. The predictions from the weather people were pretty grim, and it was a very powerful and is a very powerful storm. I'm not really sure what's happening. I mean, it seems to be going up the Florida coast. I don't know if the damage is really that great. I think the evacuations probably were wise. But it does not seem to be quite the level of what we had anticipated, and that's good. I mean, I'm you know, who wants more damage? But there's no question there's a certain amount of overhype on these things. On the other hand, they will say, well, if something really bad happens and we haven't given you all this warning, then you'll blame us for being negligent. And there's a certain amount of truth there too. But it is very, very hard to justify the hour after hour coverage when not much is happening, or when what is happening really just looks like a bad storm. I remember, and I was up actually late last night, so I watched, you know, like at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they were still at it, and they brought in, you know, the secondary teams from the networks, from the cable news networks. I you know, I think one of the people I saw may have been in a rainstorm before, may have seen rain before. I don't know. But they didn't seem to know very much, or frankly to care all that much, but they were going to do this 24-hour wall-to-wall service. It seems to me that what gets forgotten in all this is Hurricane Harvey and the damage to Houston, which seemed much greater than what this hurricane was more dramatic. But Houston apparently is still in terrible condition, and they've been completely forgotten. I mean, you know, every day the story changes, and you know, we can have World War III on 1 week and destroy half the world. 2 weeks later, well, we're about to experience World War IV. The news cycle is now so fast that stories just disappear.
Let me ask you a question, because you were you worked in television years ago. When they do this kind of thing, when they go wall to wall like this, they don't show any commercials. So I'm beginning to, I mean, do the advertisers like that? I mean, because that's, I mean, I understand the advertising has to be put on the side if there's something breaking news or whatever. But at what point is it too much against the advertisers? You know, if I was an advertiser, I'd be wondering, what are they going to put, you know, I paid for this, what are they going to put it in?
Well, you get your money back if they don't actually run it. But in this case, I've seen a lot of commercials. Both Fox and CNN, which are the ones I watch, they do, on a long story like this, they do their regular commercials, and they run it as regular programs. It's only if something very dramatic is happening that they cut the commercial for that particular time period. You know, I don't think there were any commercials during the O.J. Simpson car chase. But in something like this that's very, very long, they run commercials, and they make a lot of money on it. I don't think there were any commercials, you know, if it's a real tragedy that's occurring, and it's occurring quickly, like somebody's death or a particular event, a terrorist attack, I don't think they would run commercials during that. But, yeah, they were running commercials all through
this. I would think they have to be a little bit careful as to what commercials they run to make sure that they don't run something insensitive. During a baseball game between the Marlins and the Braves, you know how they play music between innings. They decided to play a song about a hurricane or something. That didn't go over very well. Yeah, that didn't go over well. But
people in television are kind of trained to be sensitive to make sure a commercial is not inappropriate. I remember there used to be a fairly standard practice in news organizations if there was an airplane crash, that if there were airline commercials scheduled, that they would cancel the airline commercials and they would run them at other times. And that was understandable. Then, of course, you can have, you know, a commercial that's completely inappropriate. I would not, you know, be running a commercial for tourism in Florida today. That would be something that would go down too well.
Or boats or swimming suits or something. That may not be too appropriate. But no, I actually did get an email from a really good friend in Miami in the last hour. And he said that, basically saying that they got lucky, that they really didn't get what they were expecting. And they got a lot of rain, and they're going to get a lot of rain. But they didn't get anywhere near, like you were saying, in Houston, where the hurricane went into the city. Apparently it didn't in Miami, but I mean, there's still people, you know, there's still people, I suppose, up the coast, the west coast of Florida, who are getting it as we speak. So we pray for them, and we hope that they will be okay. But I want to begin, Bill, with a quick story here that I saw this afternoon. And I figured you would have an opinion on this, so that's why I wanted to start with it. This has to do with California, a state that may very well be an independent nation here in the next couple of years or so they say. But apparently they have so much diversity in California that they have a shortage of interpreters because they actually have 220 languages that are spoken in their court system. And I understand the reason for giving a defendant his native language. I understand that, and I'm not against it. But isn't 220 maybe a little bit too much? I didn't know we had that many languages. And what it suggests to me, Bill, is that we're probably – there's some dialects in there that maybe
yes.
For example, you go to Mexico, there are parts of Mexico – where they still speak the Mayan dialect. I've been there. So, I don't know. 220, maybe it's too much.
Well, it is a reflection of what has happened in this society where we kowtow to the demands of every group. Now, I happen to agree, and you've implied it, that in court cases, people do, under law, under federal law, have the right to be treated equally regardless of their ethnic heritage, and that has been interpreted to mean they're entitled to an interpreter. That I agree with, and it is, yes, it's 120 or 220 or whatever, 220, it's a lot of languages to cover. But it is elsewhere in society that I think the real problem comes, where we are dividing this country up so completely by ethnic group and by immigrant group and by language that we're losing the sense of social cohesion. We really are, and I don't think it's something most Americans want to have happen, but it is happening. It is certainly happening on college campuses, where kids come in and they're immediately, in effect, assigned almost to their ethnic group, and you must show respect for your own culture, and you don't have to talk to anybody else, and you don't have to know anything. it's really become crazy. And what's interesting is, I think we've talked about this, there's a backlash building against this whole multicultural structure. And I think it is certainly building among parents who have to shell out the enormous amounts for college, and they don't want their kids going to a school which is just a propaganda shell. And that's what's happening. And you see colleges now really beginning to be hurt financially by a drop in applications, by a drop in contributions, as people become more and more disgusted by this.
Yeah, there was a really neat article over at Powerline. Maybe you saw this. In the last couple of days, about a school in outside Minneapolis that had all of these, was making all this effort to make sure that sixth graders or seventh graders were, conscious of their diversity and all of that. And I know one of the fellows who writes at Powerline, I'm not sure if it was Scott or who it was, said, there was a time when if you sent your kid to sixth grade, you just wanted him to learn to read and write. Diversity and all of that other stuff was not really something you were interested in. And I think you're right. I think there's a backlash. And the more, Bill, that I think about the Trump election, the more that people try to analyze why he won, I think that backlash was a big factor. I think it was Donald Trump who was speaking to these people who are sick and tired of this stuff, Bill.
Oh, they are. And by the way, I think one of the groups that's or one of the types of persons who's sick and tired of it are sometimes members of these groups who want to be Americans, and they want to be regarded as Americans, and they don't want their kids to be taught that they're different. They want them to be people to show respect for them, of course, but that they're taught that they are Americans with the same rights and privileges as any other Americans. This division of the country, I think, is turning out to be rather unpopular with the majority of people. But it is going forward nonetheless, and you hear these stories, which I think are true, from what I understand, of school systems, not simply universities, but school systems, as you just reported, the sixth grade, where the school system does not feel it has any obligations to the parents of the students. They are basically told to keep out of it. It's not their business, that they don't run the school system. We do. Well, these school systems are public school systems. The people in them are public employees. But you would never know it sometimes by their attitudes. You would think we're working for them.
Absolutely. And I think there was a case in California, I think we may have mentioned it last week, where you had, I think it was first graders or something being taught about transgenders. And down in Florida, there was a teacher who wouldn't let some kids come into the class. I think it was Florida or Georgia, one of those states, where because the kid had a Make America Great Again, and the teacher called him a Nazi. By the way, that's becoming a very popular word. Racist and Nazis are
yes.
the two most popular words, aren't they, Bill?
Well, yes, and they are becoming the words of the new McCarthyism. Back in the 50s, when we had the right-wing political correctness and McCarthyism was abroad in the land, there were some individuals, actually a fairly small number, many smaller than today, but who would use words like, this one's a communist, this one's a comm simp, this one's a fellow traveler, this one's a true believer. And the equivalent today is racist, Nazi, rape apologist. That's another one that's become big, rape apologist. And it really is just a form of left-wing McCarthyism. There's no difference really between that and what the McCarthy groups did in the 1950s.
Yes, absolutely. One quick thing about this diversity, Bill. You grew up in New York City, Brooklyn, and I have many friends at church from Brooklyn and New York, and they tell me that there was a time when there was a lot of ethnic diversity there, but that as soon as possible, you were told that you had to learn English. I have a friend from the church who was born in an Italian family, and he spoke Italian, but when he got to school, the first thing they did was to say, hey, you got to speak English. And that was probably true of some of the other immigrants. And that's where I think we've gone wrong. There's nothing wrong with diversity if you want to speak your home language to your mom or dad or whatever. I mean, I always speak Spanish with my parents, but it's when you've got every kid in school speaking a different language, that's just, it's unmanageable, Bill.
That's right. And what is so wrong about it is that it's the current practices are so unfair to these children. If they don't learn English, they won't be able to get a job. I mean, you know, they try then to go to state legislature and say it's unfair that we're excluded. But the fact of the matter is you have to speak English, you have to write English, you have to read English. And by teaching them that, no, you really don't, you can keep your own culture, you're doing a great disservice to these people. The fact of the matter is people always kept their culture. They spoke one language at home and one language in school, but they knew that when they were out of the house, they had to learn and speak English. And it was a very good thing that they did. That's what allowed them to progress. And I just don't know what's going to happen to these children who are being told by some educators, not all, oh, you don't have to learn that. You keep your own culture. They will only be employable in their own communities.
Right, and that's and there aren't a lot of jobs in those communities. It's, you know, when I was teaching English classes a few years ago, I always told the parents at these classes that if you don't learn English, you're only going to be able to – I would draw like a little circle, and I would say this is where your kids are going to live and get a job. But if they learn English, then I drew a bigger circle, and that's where they're going to be able to go. And I think most
yes.
of the parents that I had, Bill, most of the parents understood that. It's I mean, most of them were Hispanic, and there were some Asians as well, and they all seemed to understand that it was not a very difficult thing for me to sell it to them, Bill. They all knew they had to learn English. So,
yes,
you know, maybe
and they wanted to.
Yeah, maybe there's a disconnect.
They wanted their children
between,
to learn English.
Absolutely, but I'm beginning to think that maybe there's a disconnect between the actual and these communities and their so-called leaders, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. There's a tremendous disconnect. You know, I've always believed, and maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist on this, but I don't think so, that bilingual education was actually a plot to make sure Hispanic children didn't learn English. Because when they actually tested it and it went into effect, it took kids in this country something like 8 years to learn English, where other countries were doing it, were learning them, the kids were learning the native language in 1 year. And I think a lot of Hispanic parents started to raise questions about what this was really about. And I think it was a way of keeping people under control. that leaders didn't really want their constituents to make that much progress. And if you could keep them ignorant in the language of the country, they wouldn't make that much progress, and they would need those leaders, and they would keep supporting those leaders. And I truly believe that was a factor.
I think you're right. I think you're right, because I think the more they learn English, the more they break away from that community. I mean, you see that here in the Dallas area. There, you know, the Hispanics who live in the suburbs or away from the inner city, they tend to be more educated, and they speak English primarily. And the Spanish is primarily spoken in the inner city and in the communities that are heavily Hispanic. So I don't know. I just think we cannot be a nation of 220 languages. I think that's my point. I understand that the defendant has to get a fair trial. I get that. But 220, it just seems to me, is too much. That somewhere along the way, somebody's going to have to say, you know what, we don't have that interpreter. I'm sorry. That dialect, we can't find an interpreter for you. We got to figure something else out. Maybe your home country has a way of representing you in trial. I don't know. But we cannot have 220 languages in a court system, Bill. It just seems too much.
Well, you may be right. But that's what the law requires, that at least that part of it be when somebody testifies or somebody has to hear testimony that refers to them, that it has to be translated. And people are doing their best to observe the law. But look, the answer to it is to make certain that every person who comes to this country learns English, and every child in a household that is non-English speaking learns English, and it should be part of their obligation and part of our obligation to them. And to have a common tongue, and people have to understand that they have to speak and write and read that common tongue at a very high level and in a way that everybody else is. You can't have a situation where some people speak English one way and somebody else speaks English another way. We have a common language, and the purpose of language is to communicate.
And that common language should be the language of business and the language of politics or the legal system. And if it isn't, then I think it's going to get very chaotic, and it's already very chaotic in California, so they don't need any more chaos out there. We're going to take a little break, Bill. We're going to listen to one of our sponsors, and after that, we're going to talk about President Trump and quite a few other things. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, as we do on Sunday nights. We're chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, I just wanted to take a minute here and go back on this day in history. Actually, it was Friday, but we'll talk about it today. September the 8th, 1974, President Ford issued the pardon to Richard Nixon, President Nixon, and it was very controversial, as I recall. But over time, it seems like most people are seeing it as the right thing to do. I always felt that it was the right thing to do when it happened. And in fact, I remember the moment that it happened. I was with my father, and my father said, "This is going to cost them politically, but it is the smart thing to do, the right thing to do." I think my dad turned out to be right. It may have cost him his election in 76, though.
You know, I don't know if it did. That is the common belief, and going back and having lived through that period, I think that it may simply have been that Carter, who was really the consummate con artist. I mean, presenting himself as the best and the most honest and the most religious. I think maybe he had just a little edge over Ford, who was a decent man, but not the greatest candidate in the world. You know, he was kind of a dull guy. Carter presented himself as the moral answer to Watergate, which he clearly was not, but he presented himself that way. Would the pardon have made a difference? I don't know. I think it was, exactly the right thing to do. Nixon, after all, had never been charged with anything and had never been convicted of anything. He had not been impeached. Many people today think he was impeached. He was not. He probably would have been because it was a Democratic House. And I think that to grant him the pardon ended the case and ended the long national nightmare, so to speak, over Watergate. We had to go on to other things. Watergate, he handled it poorly, Nixon. I think people universally agree on that. It was not the greatest crime in human history. I mean, you know, it was a stupid little break-in that should never have happened. I've always felt that had he come out the next day after it went public, and said simply, this occurred on my watch, I disapprove of it completely, it's never going to happen again, and I'm going to tell you what things we're going to put in place to make sure it never happens again, he would have been a national hero. Instead, he tried to cover it up. And I think that's where the phrase came from, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. It was the cover-up that got him into so much trouble. And then, of course, what came out during the cover-up, which was the taping system in the White House and the vulgar comments he would make and the machinations of people around him. But he could have gotten rid of Watergate in one day had he acted properly. And I think pardoning him, what were we going to do, put him on trial? He was out of office,
right.
Can't be impeached anymore.
Yeah. Right.
Put him on trial for perjury or something. It would have gone on and on and on and on. What good was served? He was punished enough by being the first president of in American history to have to resign.
Yes. No, I think you're right, and it's almost hearing you talk right now, it's almost it reminds me of what my father was saying, that it was a Sunday, when he did it, Sunday, September the 8th, because I had just come from Mass, I remember. And hearing you describe it really reminds me of what my dad, exactly what my dad said that afternoon. But you were talking about President Trump, and I wanted to get into his presidency a little bit because he had a very interesting week. First of all, he decided to do business with the Democrats, as you indicated in your in urgent agenda. His polling numbers are going up, and I wonder how much of that has to do with the overall sense that he's on top of the job. That he may not be the nicest person or be the most diplomatic person, but he seems to be on top of the job. And I think maybe Irma and Harvey have something to do with that. The fact that government has actually done a good job in both of these, and maybe he gets credit for that. So, and then of course President Trump and DACA, you know, the young people who are here illegally, all of that happened this week, and it should be an interesting week. And this working with Democrats, I'm anxious to hear what you think of that, Bill.
Well, I think it was exactly the right thing to do. Now, you know, I put a note up at Urgent Agenda as to what my theory was, and it's only a theory, and I have to label it a speculation. But I think that Trump was – that this was a much more important moment than people realized when it first happened. I think it's a major political moment in that Trump is declaring his independence. He is saying to his party, I may be a Republican, but I'm an independent Republican, and you need me more than I need you. And to a certain degree, that's true. You know, he really holds the future of the Republican Congress in his hand. If he doesn't endorse them, if he comes out before the next election and say, I cannot endorse the Republican Congress, they didn't do anything, they could go down to a permanent defeat. He could also, and he's also really saying in a way, not using the words, I can run as an independent Republican in 2020, which means not even go for the party nomination. And that would make it impossible for any other Republican to be elected president. He has that power. He has a lot of power over the party. Now, other people disagree and they say, no, he is simply declaring himself as the head of the party. That may be true also. But whatever it is, it was a very, very smart move. It got the debt limit extension off the table for 3 months, and he is making it plain what he expects to be done during those 3 months. And if the Republican Party does not produce, they're going to be in a lot of trouble. And I think he was sending that message very clearly.
And you're right. He did take off the debt issue off the table, and he wants to, you know, it seems to me that what we're watching with President Trump, again, whether we like him or not, whether we like his style or not, we're watching a man who really understands how to run things. He's very much of an executive. And executives, a good executive, first of all, you set your priorities. And you say, okay, this is what we want, this is what we want. And getting the debt thing off the table allows him to do other things. Now, he's going to have DACA to deal with. I actually thought that was a brilliant move on his part as well, this thing with DACA, because he canceled the executive orders or extended it, whatever he did. But he's now sent it to the Congress and said to the Congress, I want you to do this. So he's putting it on Congress. And can you imagine President Trump, in the near future, Bill, actually signing a Dream Act, some kind of a version of a Dream Act, you know, surrounded by a bunch of dreamers at the White House? You know, he's giving them little pins after he signed the Dream Act. I can just imagine Democrats jumping from buildings, Bill. I mean, after Hillary losing, if now Trump does the Dream Act, I mean, you better hold on to the Democrats, because they're going to be jumping from buildings across the country, Bill.
Oh, absolutely, and they will be jumping, and then and when they hit the ground, they will expect to be covered by Obamacare.
That's right.
You know, and jumps from buildings are covered. You know, we put it into the law. That's true.
That's right.
And you know, the thing is this: the Democratic Party, as bad a situation as the Republican Party is in, I mean, it's inactive. It needs medical care. It needs they need vitamin B12 shots to get going. As bad as they are, the Democrats are in worse shape. They really are. They don't have a party that really stands for anything, except in certain cases, hatred. I mean, the people running the Democratic Party today are real. They're real haters. They hate everybody who disagrees with them. Hillary seems to have joined their ranks. She gave an interview to Jane Pauley yesterday. And went back to this old theme of the election was about angry white people who were angry because other people were succeeding. That's not true at all. They were angry that their own situation wasn't being considered by the government. And you have a party. I mean, this used to be the party of Roosevelt, Truman, and Kennedy. It was a party of real coalitions. It was a party of groups that were considered valuable to the Democratic Party. Now, they even treat some of their constituency groups terribly. They treat white working people terribly. They treat Catholics terribly. Now they're turning against Israel, so they treat the Jews terribly. What are they going to have left? You know, the Democratic Party is now narrowing itself to the point where you wonder who it represents. And eventually, some of the groups in the party will say, you know, we don't want to be in a permanent minority. Let's look at the other party.
Right.
If the
exactly.
Republicans,
and that's,
yes, go ahead.
That could happen with Hispanics, by the way. If Trump really plays that card
correctly,
you could be – I could see him being at 50% with Hispanics in 2020
yes.
because, you know, if he can get DACA off the table – DACA is a very divisive issue. You know, I read that something like 80% of these youngsters, the so-called DACA youngsters, and they're not all youngsters, but I mean that's the popular expression of these DACA young people. Something like 80% of them live in five states: Texas, California, Florida, New York, and Illinois. So the other 45 states, it's not even an issue. Nobody even knows what a dreamer is. But the reason for bringing up the thing about the five states is that we're hearing it a lot down here. I mean, in Texas, it's a big issue, and it's an issue that I think merits consideration. I mean, I have always felt that I'm not saying that all of them should be legalized. I think there has to be a definition of what a dreamer is. But I mean, it's hard for me to hold it against a 20-year-old that his parents brought him here when he was 3 or 4. It's just hard for me to hold it against them. It would be easier to give this young person just legalize this young person in one way or another, get this very contentious issue off the table. And I think just removing this issue off the table, Bill, will make it much easier for President Trump to deal with Hispanics, because this is a sore point and particularly the Mexican-American community, Bill?
Well, it's absolutely correct. And I think going back to what you said just a minute ago, that I think the Hispanic community is a great target community for the Republican Party for several reasons. One is that, from what I've noticed in life, parties and political movements that fail often fail because they don't appreciate the passage of time. And they don't understand that things change over time and that an earlier victory cannot be necessarily be repeated. What you're getting into, you know this far better than I do, you're getting into a new generation now of Hispanic citizens, the second generation of immigrants, and they think exactly like the second generation of immigrants in any other group, that they want to be Americans, they want to make progress, they want to go to college, they don't want to be professional organizers. And they want to participate in capitalism, have their own businesses, and we see more and more becoming executives and becoming college professors. And I think that if the Democratic Party doesn't understand that and keeps treating groups as simply angry groups of enraged citizens, they're going to go out of existence. They're going to find that nobody wants to be a perpetual victim.
Well, it's interesting because after President Trump made the announcement about DACA, I remember I didn't hear him, but I saw him on television with the microphone screaming, you know, Tom Perez, the chairman of the Democrat Party. And he was really angry and mad. And I could kind of tell what he was saying. He was basically saying that Trump hates immigrants. I mean, the usual crap about what Trump was doing. But, you know, at no time, of course, did he ever say that when they had majorities, they didn't do a darn thing about any of this, which is something that I think is becoming more and more clear. I had the opportunity on Friday afternoon I was interviewed by Telemundo, and they're showing it today. And we were talking about this whole issue, and there was a dreamer there who was with me in the set, and we were talking, and it was a very interesting conversation because the moderator said to me, well, don't you have any sympathy for him? And I said, of course I do. I don't have anything against this young man. He looks like a very nice young man, like one of my sons, and very well-dressed and all of that. I have nothing against him, well-spoken young man. But then I said to the moderator, but you know who I also have sympathy for? The 4 million people who are currently in line waiting to come into the United States legally. I also have sympathy for them. And this is where the Democrats get lost. They only focus on this one issue, the illegal immigration issue. And there's, I mean, 4 million people, that's a lot of people, Bill, who are waiting for their families. I mean, each one of those people on that list has a family member in the United States, probably more. And they come from all these other countries, not just Latin America. But they're waiting legally to come into the country. And so I said to the moderator, I also have sympathy for them. And nobody marches for them. I don't see any marches for the people waiting to come into the country legally, Bill.
That's right. And I think very often when you engage in groupthink, as the Democratic Party does, they forget things like that. They concentrate on this group and then on that group, and they don't concentrate on the people who get hurt. And that may also include members of that group. I'll give you an example, and that is this Democratic Party suicidal mission to pretend that we don't have a crime problem, or if we do, it's all caused by racism. That's not the way most African Americans see it. They, you know, when Rudy Giuliani went on his campaign in New York to break crime, and he did, he succeeded, his police commissioner, second police commissioner, Ray Kelly, went into black communities all the time, and he spoke at churches, and he always got a standing ovation. Now, he was the man who the Democrats said, you're supposed to hate this guy. He's the police commissioner. He's oppressing you. And they didn't hate him. They liked him. They knew what he was doing and how it was benefiting them. So very often I think that, you know, you made a point a few minutes ago about leaders versus people. I think the problem with organizations like the Democratic Party is they speak only to leaders. They don't really speak to people. Now, when I was in the Democratic Party many decades ago and we campaigned, we went directly to people. We liked our constituent groups. We liked laboring people. We liked people who were churchgoers in big cities. And our relationship was directly with them. the Democratic Party today seems to be run more like the socialist parties of Europe, where they kind of preside over people and never actually hear their voices. And I think they're in trouble.
I think so, too. I think they're in big trouble, which may very well be the only thing going for the Republicans at the moment.
Well, that's right.
Is that the Democrats are in worse shape than they are. And the Democrats, it doesn't seem to me, Bill, that the Democrats have done anything to make up for the 2016 defeat. The Republicans keep helping them because they're not being very good at it. But the Democrats, you know, I still think the Republicans have an edge on the cultural issues. Look what happened to this lady Feinstein, Senator Feinstein. Look at this lady. She made a couple of statements. I mean, all she said is that President Trump could be a good president. You would think
that's
that the world is coming upside down. Then she's interviewing some lady, I guess, for a position as a judge. And she's giving this, she's almost like giving this lady a test, a religious test. And it was all because of abortion and same-sex marriage. That's the funny thing about it. I guess is from Notre Dame. But
Notre Dame University.
And
what is so strange about it is that Dianne Feinstein, who is the senator you're talking about, is one of the grown-ups in the Senate. And not only that, she graduated from Catholic school. Now, she is nominally Jewish, but she actually was educated in Catholic school. She went to the Convent of the Sacred Heart. And she knew better. She knew better. I have no idea what she had in mind, giving this woman a religious test. I think what she was trying to ask was, would your religious beliefs affect your judicial opinions? But that isn't even an appropriate question unless there's some record that it would, because these are prominent law professors. They know what the rules are. It was just so silly, and Durbin asked the same questions. I mean, I don't know what has happened to the Democratic Party. This is the party, after all, that put forward the first Catholics to run for the presidency. Alfred E. Smith in 1928, and, of course, Jack Kennedy in 1960. And I remember how Jack Kennedy, as a practicing Catholic, had to go before a group of Protestant ministers in Texas, the Houston ministers, as they called them, to prove that he wasn't going to be controlled by the Pope. And you would never think that a Democrat would pull that kind of thing. I don't know what got into her that day. That's usually not the way she acts. But she has not yet apologized for it, which she should have, or at least clarified what she said. And I don't know if she realizes what she did was wrong, especially someone educated as she was in Catholic schools. So it's just absolutely, absolutely baffling.
Well, I wonder, Bill, because this came a couple of days after her problems in California when she made those remarks about President Trump, and now they're even talking about, you know, giving her a primary challenge. I wonder, and it's just a crazy conspiracy on my part, perhaps, but I wonder if she was trying to make up with some of the people in the left and saying, I don't know.
I think you're right.
but it was really bizarre, you know, to have this extremely competent lady who's being considered for a judge to have to, in a sense, prove that being a Catholic, or that she's not going to, I mean, it's the same thing as you were saying as they did to John Kennedy, almost identical to what was done to John Kennedy. And the idea that, as you say, a Democrat would do it is absolutely bizarre. Quickly, Bill, on North Korea, and then we'll come back for another segment later, but on North Korea, it's getting to the point now where, you know, who knows what's going to happen, but I wouldn't be surprised. There was a rumor going around Friday evening, that President Trump had in fact given the military the okay on shooting down the next missile. Bill, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. In fact, I'd like to see that happen. I'd like to see President Trump make a big statement the next time he fires a missile, Bill.
Well, I would like to see it, too. I don't know what his military advisors are saying. They seem to be very much against military action, or at least some of them are, because they're afraid of the possibility of a ground war in Korea, and that's a very legitimate fear. But I think Trump is serious when he says that he's serious. when Obama said he was serious, nobody ever took him seriously because he was never serious. But Trump is a different animal, and it's interesting. This weekend marks the anniversary of the birth of North Korea as a nation, and they're having these celebrations. And there is the fear that he will launch another missile, but it hasn't happened so far. It is possible that some sense has been talked into Kim Il Jong or whatever his name is. I can never remember the whole thing. And we'll have to see what happens next. What Trump is doing is he's hardening our military situation by selling very advanced equipment immediately to Japan and South Korea so they can participate more fully. I think we are sending more military assets into the area. I don't know if our anti-missile systems in that area are adequate to do the job, to shoot down a missile. That's highly classified information. And we are going on Monday to the United Nations to ask for very severe sanctions against North Korea, which we probably won't get because of the presence of Russia and China at the UN. But at least we are asking for them and indicating that we are prepared to go much further than we are now. Now, one of the things that happened a few days ago that really enraged me was that Angela Merkel of Germany got involved in this and started talking to the leaders of Russia and China, and I thought that was outrageous because we are so clearly the lead nation there. She's going to be reelected shortly to become Chancellor of Germany again, but she is really becoming a thorn in our side. She regards herself as quite a bit wiser than Donald Trump, and she's interfering in these things. And when Europeans interfere, what usually follows is appeasement of some kind. She says that the Iran nuclear deal should be an example of what can be achieved with North Korea. Well, my God, if that's the example you're going to go with, count me out, because the Iran nuclear deal was a terrible, terrible deal. So we have complications here, but I do think Trump is serious, and I would not put it past him, and I agree with you, it would be a good thing if we could get one of their assets militarily, just one, just to show determination. And if we could knock down one of those missiles, it would be good.
I think so. I think it would be a sign that he's indeed very serious, and it would certainly be a sign to China, although I think they know that President Trump is serious. By the way, speaking of Germany, before we take a break, I always love being lectured by the Germans or by the Europeans. It turns out that Germany is way behind on their 2020 green energy or whatever they were supposed to be in 2020 with respect to green energy. They're way behind schedule. So these are the people who wanted us to sign the Paris Climate Agreement, right? But they don't seem to be doing much to live up to it. I mean, so if they're not living up to their own green stuff, you know, what makes you think that signing the agreement would have done any different, Bill?
I agree with you. The Europeans, the West Europeans, are becoming increasingly irrelevant. Their countries have very, very poor futures unless they increase their native birth rates. They're becoming increasingly Islamicized. That doesn't mean there'll be a majority Islamic population, but enough to turn an election. I mean, if France becomes 10 or 15 or 20% Islamic, that can be the deciding vote in an election, and they'll begin to lose their culture. That, of course, is exactly what the left wing wants in Europe. They don't believe in these cultures. They believe they're old colonial empires, and we must go to a multicultural future. Well, when they get there, send me a letter and find, tell me how you like it. You know, they are really in trouble as countries, and I think around the world that's recognized. You know, if you look, for example, at the foreign policy of a country like Israel, it's now beginning to turn east. They're beginning to develop very good relationships with India, with China, and where will the Prime Minister of Israel be this week? Latin America. They're kind
interesting.
He's making a tour of Latin America, and they are developing very good relationships. In fact, he's going to be in Mexico, and they have offered aid to Mexico, their technical aid involving the results of the earthquake. So countries are now beginning to realize that Western Europe is not where it's at. It really is.
No, it really isn't, and I think the whole world knows that. But I just thought it was laughable, Bill, that they're not going to meet their 2020 agreement, but they were preaching to everybody else to sign the Paris agreement. We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with one more segment with our friend Bill right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. We have a few more minutes with our friend Bill. We're going to look at next week. But before we do, Bill, I got to tell you the story. You brought up that the Prime Minister of Israel is going down to Mexico. He's going to find a very large Mexican Jewish community there. I have many friends in Mexico who are Jewish religion. And one of the largest athletic clubs in Mexico City is what they call the Jewish Center, el Centro Judío. And it's huge. I mean, it's a very popular place where they have a lot of traditional Jewish culture and so on. It's a great place to visit, by the way. I've been there a few times with my Jewish friends. So I think you'll find a lot of friends in Mexico when he visits Mexicoville.
Well, that's interesting. And I think also, you know, what the international language today is becoming technology. And I think Mexico has made great strides in that. We don't necessarily see it on the surface because it doesn't often show up in the trade agreements, but countries like Brazil are making great strides in technology. Mexico, Cuba could make enormous strides if the jackboot of the Castros was released, because Cuba is an educated country. I see Cuba in the future, if democracy is allowed to flourish there, as like another Israel in the Western Hemisphere, a country that has a tremendous amount of potential and technology. But that is clearly becoming the international language.
Absolutely. No, you're exactly right. And I think Mexico is intelligently looking beyond the United States. I think they would like to diversify, not because they don't want to do business with the United States. Obviously, they have to, because of the size of the trade. But I think they're beginning to look at other countries, and Israel makes a lot of sense because Israel has a lot of technology and so on. So that makes a lot of sense for the Prime Minister to visit Mexico. I hope he goes to Argentina, and I hope he goes to Colombia. And, of course, Brazil is a natural because that's the eighth largest economy in the world. Bill, before we run out of time, I did want to ask you about a fascinating post that you wrote this week about people looking for alternative or finding alternative ways of getting the news. And I find myself doing that. I find myself more and more getting the news, yourself, Urgent Agenda. That's a great service that you provide. And a lot of people seem to be looking beyond the traditional. But this, it's understandable, Bill, as you wrote in your post.
That's absolutely correct, because people can now carry the news around with them. And I find it, I have not seen a network news broadcast. When I say network, I'm talking about the big three, in years. I don't find them terribly informative, or I didn't when the last time I looked. And they're very slanted to the left, which everybody knows. So if I watch television, I will watch one of the 24-hour services, and I like the programs on Fox. But if I want real news, I go to the Internet, and I find far more news available to me. I find a much greater variety of voices, and I find it. I get it anytime I want to. I'm not dependent on a broadcast schedule. So, yes, I think the future of news is on the Internet, and that has helped our side politically, because the mainstream press is so left-wing nowadays that going on the Internet is really kind of a relief. You get all the voices.
That's right. And I think it's generational too, Bill, because I noticed my sons, if you told my sons about NBC Nightly News, they wouldn't even know what that is.
That's right.
And these are very well-educated young men, one who graduated from law school with honors, one who got an MBA from Texas A&M in accounting. I mean, he's a well-educated young man. I have another
yes.
one who's getting a degree in computer science. So, I mean, these are well-educated young men. They wouldn't, you know, they don't even know what the nightly news is. They get most of their stuff from the internet as well. So I think it's actually good news, like you're saying. I think it's good. I think it gives you more information, like you say, and there's more variety as well when you're looking for this. Well, as we look at next week, we've got a couple of minutes here, Bill, to next week. Obviously, North Korea could change anything in a heartbeat. But what other stories are you following next week?
Well, clearly the aftermath of the hurricanes. You know, as we say on Urgent Agenda, we're not weather reporters, but we look at the political and economic ramifications, and the political ramifications can be enormous. I do think that the whole tone in Washington changed as a result of these terrible weather events because people started to work together. And I think the president has been greatly strengthened. He's up to 46% in the Rasmussen poll, and that doesn't sound like very high, but for him it's high, and actually most presidents spend a lot of their presidencies wobbling around in the 40s and low 50s. So he's getting there, and I think that the country watching Americans working together are going to be a lot more impressed by that than with gridlock. In a way, it has given Trump an excuse to work with the opposition party, and he's taking that excuse. We'll also be looking, as you said, at North Korea. You have to look at that because, as you pointed out, it can change in a heartbeat. Also, this is the first, well, because of the weather delayed this, but this will be the first week or coming period will be the first period after Labor Day in the year before a major election. And the way the schedules work these days, the election campaigns have already begun for 2018. 2018 will be crucial. If the Democratic Party cannot make progress in 2018, they will be in really serious trouble as a party. And I would not
right.
be shocked to find a third party.
Right, and they'll be shocked. I mean, they'll be disappointed within the party that they didn't make gains. I think another story, Bill, that may not be next week, but it's happening, is the case of Senator Menendez in New Jersey, because
yes.
if he has to resign, and it appears that he may have to, then that's a Republican that goes into that seat. And, you know, how that changes Obamacare and a few other things, I don't know. But that could happen. Also in Arizona, Senator McCain, we wish him the best. He's one of my real heroes. I wish him the very best. But, you know, his health is deteriorating. He may be...
It is.
Hate to say it, but you know, he may be dead within a year because of,
yes.
of his cancer. I hope not, but it could happen. And if that
yes.
happens, he's going to be replaced by a much more conservative Republican, by everything I hear. So that's a couple of, you know, that's a couple of political changes that could make a big difference in the politics in the next 12 months, Bill.
It can. And speaking of Arizona, remember that President Obama, President Trump has basically written Jeff Flake out of the Republican Party. And Jeff Flake is in trouble. Senator Flake is in trouble in Arizona. And if Trump can demonstrate that kind of power to basically almost decapitate a Republican in favor of another Republican, that's real muscle. And he's showing it. It's going to be a fascinating political year. It really will be.
Absolutely. And we'll spend. Quite a bit with you, Bill, reading Urgent Agenda and chatting with you on Sunday nights. But have a great evening, and I hope the Cowboys beat the Giants tonight. They're playing tonight. And I will talk to you the next time, Bill. Thank you, as always.
Absolutely. Looking forward to next week.
All right. Thank you so much. Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Always have a lot of fun talking with Bill. We talked about a lot of things tonight. Fascinating show. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.